The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Characteristics printed on both sides. So help yourself to one, pass them down through. There should be enough. If you can't find one, raise your hand and there's some extra somewhere, both kinds. Our topic is understanding the people you serve. Now, I think that the first problem to solve here is that how can we serve many people? It's easy to divide the attention, divide the affections. The Bible tells us we can't serve two masters, and so we can easily be frittered, confused in our work by trying to please everybody. We know the old story of the man who and his son who took the donkey to market and drove the donkey first, and then they tried to please everybody by eventually someone told them that at least one of them should ride. So the son rode a while, and then after a while they met someone and said, "Well, goodness, what's the world coming to? These young people make their parents walk, and so the father should be riding." So the father rode and the son walked. And then after a while somebody said, "Well, you shouldn't force your young son to walk. Why don't you let him ride?" Well, so they both rode a while. And finally somebody criticized him for doing that. "You're better able to carry him than he is to carry both of you." And so they picked the donkey up, carried him, and eventually as they crossed the bridge, why, they lost the donkey in the stream. They didn't have anything, and they learned the hard way that you can't please everybody. So how are we, when we work in schools, to please the parents, please the board, please our students, please the Lord? And how are we to be faithful to principles of teaching? How are we to do this? Well, it takes some understanding, and there is an answer. Somehow we have to be able to have one master, to have one purpose, to have one life. It's fascinating how if you've ever watched a sheepdog work, he looks very closely to the eye of the master. And then the sheepdog, when he works with the sheep, also looks in the eye of the sheep. And the dog who is pleasing his master looks to the eye of the master. And any servant who pleases the master looks very closely to the eye of the master, and more importantly, he's going to understand the heart of the master. And a true servant understands the master's heart, understands his lord's heart, his employer's heart, and he wants to do what his master wants done. So, to orient ourselves here, I have a few scriptures and thoughts that are a bit, maybe not in neurological order, but they do relate to the subject. I think, first of all, we want to look at the concept of serving and of the importance of serving. There's a verse in Galatians that reminds us that we have been called unto liberty. Now, that tells us, well, we are free. We're called to liberty. But liberty is a fascinating concept. It really, if we're truly free, that means that we're no longer have the chains of bondage that keep us from doing that which we should do. And furthermore, we are equipped to do that which we should do. It goes on to say then, "Don't use liberty as an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another." And so liberty is the freedom to do what we're made to do, as opposed to bondage, and by love we serve one another. We give and we nurture and we help. And that love is what drives us to teach. That's what can have us stick with it through thick and thin, through the stressful experiences that we just heard about in the story in the last session. It sounds very good to, very interesting with all these things we can do in teaching and learning. But we all know that when we get to working with the individual children, there's some very hard work to do. It's one thing to be able to explain something in the way somebody can understand. It's something else to somehow motivate that person to want to learn when he doesn't even want to understand. And so somehow we have to have this love that drives us to serve. A servant, really, if you check out the etymology, it's almost synonymous with a slave. One who is bound to another and waits upon him, obeys his needs. One who is so closely attuned to the one that he serves that he actually almost anticipates the needs, the request before the word is given. A true servant will know his master, will know his employer so well that he'll know that in a given situation or at this time of day, this is what he will ask me to do even before the request is given. And so his eyes and his heart are on the one he serves. And the concept that's used for us as bondservants for the Lord is not one who is bound against our will, but one who's actually been freed, and then one who has turned around and had the all through the ear to the door and made ourselves a love servant for the Lord for the rest of our lives. Now, as we serve, we might think of getting tired, wearing out, burning out. There's a promise in Isaiah that they that wait upon the Lord, and I think waiting here probably primarily means the kind of waiting that a waiter does, or a waitress, one who waits upon the needs of the Lord, waits upon the commands of the Lord, waits upon the requests of the Lord, the direction of the Lord. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles, run and not be weary, walk and not faint. Jesus said that my meat is to do the will of him that sent me. And that suggests that actually he received energy. He received sustenance. He received nourishment. He received strength from out of the process of doing his Father's will, out of serving his Father. And so if we are truly serving with the heart of a servant and serving God, he gives the necessary energy, the necessary motivation, the necessary wisdom in order to do that. When we execute a will, carry out a will, in an estate, for example, why there's provision given that the estate itself will provide the needed money if necessary for the executor to take the time to do the work. And the same thing is true with God's will. He provides the energy and the motivation, the zeal to carry it out. We don't have to get the energy someplace else to carry out God's will. So this whole idea of serving, I'm spending a bit of time on this at the beginning because this whole mindset of serving really gives us the love that we heard about in the opening verse this afternoon, carrying our children on our hearts. This gives us the love, the affection, the motivation, the desire to be with them. It's wonderful as a teacher to have the experience, and I've had it sometimes already. I can't say it's that way every weekend, but I've already had the experience of a weekend seeming a bit long. And that is that Monday morning didn't come quite soon enough. It was time, I look forward to the opportunity of working with those students again. It isn't always that way, but it's wonderful to actually enjoy being with the students, to carry them in our hearts, to enjoy the privilege of working with them. Now, before we get on to talk, though, about the students, let's keep this focus on serving the Lord. My point in this whole introduction here is that we really have one person to serve. We don't have divided loyalties. We serve one person. We serve God. And if we can somehow serve Him through the people that we work with, then we don't have this divided loyalty. So the Lord, the foundation of the Old Testament is the greatest commandment. The Lord is one Lord. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Now, there's another proverb that says, if your eye is single, your whole body is full of light. It's It's important to have a single focus, a single purpose, a single goal, a single soul that's fixed on one purpose of serving God. And that, if we have just the one Lord, that provides a unity, that provides an integration as opposed to disintegration. Somehow it's so, we talk in our society today, we think about being busy, about the busyness of life, and our time is frittered away doing this and that. We rush here and there, and we talk about the rat race and all the responsibilities. It's true that we have work to do, we have hard work to do and loads to lift. However, when we have a single goal, a single eye, a single purpose, it really gives unity, and all of our actions can serve one end. Our goal is really to serve the Lord. Every thought, I believe Paul said, he brought every thought into captivity. Now that's quite a challenge. If your thoughts flit and float around like butterflies, like mine do sometimes, it's one thing to control maybe your eating habits or your exercise or devotions, but to bring your thoughts into captivity and to focus our work towards one goal takes the grace of God. It's difficult. But somehow we need to do what we do to the Lord, control the trend to dissipation, daydreaming. One Lord. I had a note here, no split personality. Well, if somehow we can have an integrated life, that we live for one purpose, and the things that we do somehow count. I remember my father saying, he wasn't a talker so much, but he would say, you should try to make every move count. And he was a farmer, and pretty much lived what he said. If the things that we read, the plans we make, conversations we have, whatever we do, if we can always have this purpose, this goal of serving God and serving Him through the people we work with, why, we don't have to have this division, this fritteredness that we sometimes feel. We have one life, one passion. There's a verse we might sing that I like in our hymnal. I have it just quoted here. Let's turn to 217 and sing that one verse. It's in the Song of Spirit of God, and it's verse 5. Teach me to love thee as thine angels love. One holy passion filling all my frame. Sing that last verse. Teach me to love thee as thine angels love. One holy passion filling all my frame. Love that is mother and descended A teacher needs to have some passion. If we look at the background, the connotations of passion, it actually is associated with suffering. With suffering. To be moved by external events, to allow yourself to be touched by things that come to you from the outside. Person who's not passionate is really lives kind of unto himself. He's not open to be touched with other people's concerns, interests, needs, And an impassionate person, in some senses, perhaps would be a lifeless person, we might think, would be some of the connotations. But also, passion suggests being very compelling, stirring, and it involves the emotions. However, passion can be misdirected. It's important that the passion be attached to things that are valid, or that we be moved by the proper things, touched by the proper things. Now, let's remember that I suppose everyone is passionate about something. And children are too. Sometimes it takes us a while to figure out what it is that people do care about. But it's important as teachers that we care about those whom we work with and the material that we work with. Associated with this passion is fervor, which has more to do with a sticking to it, a steady burn, a warm and steady. It's associated with fermenting, swarming like bees, busyness, keeping at it steadily. So we need to be fervent. The Bible talks about being fervent in spirit. It's difficult to teach if we don't have a cause. You can tell if a person has a cause. He's got that spring in his step, the glow in his eyes, the persistence. He's got a goal. He's got something he's working towards. And students also need a cause. We might call it motivation. And it's important that we find a valid cause, one that's worthwhile, one that will last. And then associated with that also is being zealous, having zeal. Now, it's possible to be zealous about a wrong thing, to have a zeal that's not according to knowledge. So just being zealous itself isn't enough. It requires a valid knowledge. Zeal can be misdirected. So, in summary, with the introduction, what I'm saying here is that we need to have somehow a goal of one, a single eye, our eye on God, passionate about serving God. In order to do that, we need to see Him, to love Him, to want to serve Him, and to find our joy and purpose in serving God. So then, as we ask the question, what about then the people we serve? Well, there are people all around us whom we serve. The first one that we need to head the list with is God. He is a person. He is a person, and we do serve Him. And actually, He's the only one we serve in a way. All other service is serving as unto the Lord, and He asks us to work with others, to relate to others, but in doing so, we're really serving Him. And so, a few things to remind ourselves. We know this, but it does us good to remind ourselves some things about the heart of God. If we're going to serve this Lord then in the classroom, what about His heart? I remember a teacher interview some years ago, one of the persons on the staff committee who helped do interviewing asked a curious question. He was not a man of many words, and this was a person who was rather well known in the community, and it was rather unusual for him to accept a part-time job at this school with the experience he had before. Anyway, later on in the interview, someone asked him, this man asked the candidate, he said, "May I ask you a question?" "Sure," he said. He said, "What makes you tick?" And the person was was verbal enough that he could answer that question. But that's a question that we wonder sometimes, we wonder about students, what makes them tick? Sometimes we think they don't tick. Well, everyone ticks somewhere or somehow. And so, what is really the heart of God? Well, He tells us. Much we don't comprehend the depth of the heart of God. I'm not suggesting that. However, He tells us enough that we can know quite a bit. Let's look at a few of them. He calls us friends if we do His will. God wants us for a friend. And He takes the initiative in calling us friends. So He has a heart of a friend, and He certainly has gone the second mile and showing Himself friendly. So He's a friend of ours, and He wants us to be His friend. God also has affections. He Himself has affections. He sets his affections on us. He has a heart that is on us. He is looking on us. He is watching us. He is also passionate. We're told that Jesus was touched with a feeling of our infirmities. And he feels deeply with us. In Zephaniah, there's that fascinating verse in 3:17 that says that he sings over his people with joy. He sings over his people. And he suffered for us. And so he certainly feels very deeply about us. Let's remind ourselves of that when the going gets tough or when the going is easy. God feels with us. He feels with us. Also, he desires to bless us. He wants to. This is the heart of God toward us. We need to remind ourselves. He wants to bless us, and he's actually looking around to see whom he can give his blessings. We as teachers know very well that you can't give somebody something he's not prepared to receive. It's pointless to try to teach calculus to fourth graders. It's pointless to try to teach first graders difference between verbals and gerunds. They don't have the machinery to receive it yet. And so the same thing is true, though. God has many things to give us. He wants to bless us with that we're perhaps not ready. We're not ready to receive, but he does have something to match where we are today. He wants to show himself mighty. And he promises that I will just call upon me and I will answer your prayers. He also desires to have fellowship with us. He desires to have a relationship with us. Just as we with students desire to have a good rapport and relationship with our students, he does even more so with us. He wants to be one with us. He wants to, as it were, walk with us in the cool of the garden. And if we don't respond, and if we're not open to him, he'll ask us like he did Adam, where are you? He also wants to seek and say that which was lost, which is the relationship that he once had in the garden. And so, let's remember the first one we want to understand. If we want to understand the people we serve, the first one is to remind ourselves that we serve the Lord, and we need to know his heart. And there are many things we could add to this list, but these are just a few basic ones about his heart. He loves us, we're his friends, he's affectionate towards us, he wants to bless us, and this is the first step. If our heart is turned properly to God, then we can, he in turn will turn our hearts properly towards others and towards children. Now, I included three other groups here just to point out that there are many groups that we serve, but that's not really our topic today, so I'll just skip, hop over these. We also serve our families, and that's really the foundation for work outside the home. Love begins at home. The home is a basic institution. It's important, especially as teachers, that we have proper relationships and serve and care and relate properly whatever our home is, whether it's with our parents, whether we're rooming somewhere, wherever our home is, that we have proper relationships there. And then, again, in the church, we must be part of active part of a congregation and experience really restored and maintain healthy Christian relationships. And in our neighborhood, those that we move among and live among, we care about others. And as we have these proper relationships in our everyday life and our other contacts outside of school, that's really the life we teach out of. One of our topics I'll be tomorrow is teaching from the abundant heart, or teaching out of the heart. We must maintain these relationships in order to be in a position to serve properly in the classroom. Now we move to the two main groups then in the school, our parents and students. So at the bottom of your paper, we see parents. Parents we're very much accountable to our parents of our students, because they're the ones who hold their children in trust. Now, as we think of the parents and their hearts as teachers, our question is, what is the heart of a parent toward his child? How does my parent look at his child? How does he feel about his child? What are his concerns, his prayers, his burdens for his child? I have outlined here a few basic ones which we do well to remind ourselves of and keep in mind as we plan lessons, as we discuss things, bring things up in class. And here they are. Remember that the parents do hold their children in trust, and they're accountable before God for the way their children are brought up, the way they bring them up. They actually participated with God in creation with their children. And then God and the parents together, God through the parents, they work to, in a sense, finish the creation as the children grow up and mature. And teachers, as the children come to school, are taking a part in that. And so your parents have a very important interest in what kinds of attitudes are you helping to develop in the child. What's the approach that you're taking as you teach my child? Because I'm responsible as a parent, speaking as a parent, I'm responsible for this child, the kinds of attitudes he develops, the environment that he's in, what he learns. Because if he learns things that are not healthy, part of it's going to fall back on my responsibility for having put him in that situation. So the parents are responsible for the climate in which they place their children to learn. And they are then really giving you as a teacher quite a bit of trust when they send that child 180 days a year to sit in your classroom. You're going to have a tremendous impact, probably more by your spirit and your attitude than by the facts or the skills that you teach. Going to the other side of the paper, your parents are accountable for what the children learn in the sense that they're accountable for what allow them to be taught. They're not in the classroom, but they're the ones who enrolled them in the school. So in a sense, they hold responsibility for that. It's important for us to understand and respect the convictions of parents. Some parents will believe some things or think some things that are different from what you do. And some of these differences must be respected. And some are quite valid. And so there are always, we need to be sure that we never teach anything in a way that undercuts a child's respect for his parent. Suppose you're talking in science about the creation and about dinosaurs, about the fossils that were found in rocks and so on. There may be some parents who say, well, there were no dinosaurs. And that's something that was concocted by scientists, and we don't. Such things did not exist. As a teacher, you do not want to pass that kind of thing off and simply say, well, it's very obvious that there were, God wouldn't have just put bones in the rocks there to fool us or to lead us on just to trick us. Of course the problem with dinosaurs is not at all dinosaurs. The problem is only age and when they live. But that's not to go into that topic further, other than to point out that when parents especially if children bring up something in class, say, well, my father says, or my mother believes this, we need to be very careful that, and the Lord will give the wisdom there if we have the heart to respect the parent and the parent's thoughts, that we always maintain, and the child should maintain a respect for what the parent is and believes. That doesn't mean that we can't have honest discussions about things and about whatever's in the text. But we always want to build and respect those relationships. Parents often have a feeling of inadequacy. About the time parents learn how to raise children, the children are raised. and then when they might feel that they know how to do it well, they're finished. And then it's time for the next generation to raise children. And when the first child is born, parents never have experience because it's the first. And so it's very common for parents to have a sense of inadequacy and of uncertainty. With changing children, because children are not static, children change as they grow up. And just because about the time you learn how to relate to a six-year-old, he's seven. About the time you learn how to relate to a seven-year-old, then he's eight. Then when you think you know how to relate to an eight-year-old, and your next child gets to be eight, well, then he has an eight-year-old with an older sibling. And so you really never have a replicated experience as parents. It seems that every situation almost is new. There are similarities, but so children are changing. And then also we're living in changing times. And parents sometimes feel, well, I don't know about computers or books or the job world. I'm just not sure. They may feel very bewildered and uncertain and inadequate. These are common feelings of parents. Parents also, when we think of the hearts of parents, they're often very busy, very stressed with the cares of life, raising their children, feeding the family, taking care of the cares of life. And so we might think that parents sometimes don't give the attention or support to the schoolwork that they might do. Well, let's remember that those parents are very busy. We're working with their children full time. That's what we're focused on. But they, in addition to working with their children, they have many other responsibilities. Parents tend to be very trusting. Sometimes they hope that the teacher can do what they can't do. Some parents say, well, I couldn't get through to the child in that way. I hope the teacher can. And in fact, schools in general are being expected sometimes to do things today that beyond the scope of what they're capable of doing, especially in the public sector. So they're often very trusting. Also, parents feel somewhat threatened sometimes, especially if they come in to a parent-teacher conference. They may be wondering, now you as a teacher might feel a bit on the edge there too. You wonder, what's the parent going to be asking about what Johnny learned or didn't learn? But they may also be wondering, what's the teacher going to tell me about Johnny? What's Johnny been saying about home or about all this? And so they may feel awkward, somewhat inadequate, because they may perceive that the teacher is a professional and I'm not, so they may feel a bit ill at ease there. We need to be aware of that. And when we talk with them, be open, be honest, and help them to feel comfortable in that we're working together in this, serving each other. Parents generally carry their children very deeply on their hearts, very closely on their hearts. They care very much about their children, about what their future will be. They often have a goal. They may not. And some parents have the heart of the child. Some do not have the heart of the child. Some feel that the heart of the child is really not turned to them, and they feel frustrated. So these are some common feelings of parents. And as we think of relating to parents and serving the parents, pleasing the parents, helping the parents, let's remember these things. They love their children. They care deeply. They're responsible. They are trustees for the children. They brought them into the world. They raised them. They're very stressed. And always, always seek to build relationships with parents, between parents and children, between ourselves and parents, and between ourselves and children as we work together. My last comment there is never, never steal the heart of a child from a parent. What I mean by that is be careful. Children will sometimes, especially at certain ages, they will believe what the teacher says above what the parent says for a variety of reasons. Maybe it's simply because they think the teacher knows more about the subject. Maybe it's because for some reason they have the teacher's their hero this year. Or for a variety of other reasons, they might put more stock in what the teacher says and what the parent says. You need to be careful about that. Be aware of that. And as you always, always seek to to build respect, appreciation in the heart of the child for the parent. Never allow the child to set his affections on you above the parent. Now, we've been talking about parents, but as we remember when I started out, we really are serving the Lord. We're serving the Lord. And as we do that, that is our focus, then we serve the Lord through serving parents. And so really, the Lord is our Lord, our focus. And if there is a conflict somehow, if it seems to us that we're between a rock and a hard place, that we can't be honest or keep integrity here and yet do what we need to do in the parents' request here, and how do we do this? Well, we need to go back to the primary thing. I'm serving the Lord, and pray about that and ask the Lord. And He will give the wisdom for that. Now let's turn our attention to children. What about the hearts of our children? Well, one of the first things is the children are affectionate, especially young children. They do have affections. They'll let you know that. And they're going to set them on something. They will set them on something. And their feelings are very genuine. Depending what age you're working with, if you have third grade girls, you might wonder whether they have anything other than feelings sometimes. But they are important. And they're valid. And as we work with them, we need to remember that we're not working with brains only. We don't have 33 brains in the room to teach. We have 33 or 20, whatever, 15 people, whole people. And let's keep in mind that they want to feel. They want to feel. Someone has said that a child needs, every day, a child needs someone to love and something to care about, and something to learn, something like that. But they are feeling people, and their affections are part of this learning process. So let's remember, if there's not something in our schoolwork, in our day's program for them to feel about, it's going to be boring. Same thing is true here as you sit here. If we don't feel about our work and about our topic, well, it's boring. It's not really perhaps applicable to what we had to do. That is a valid part. They also have age-related problems that are real and genuine. As a child grows up, we need to remember, it seems sometimes that teachers who had to struggle themselves find it easier to relate to children than those who had all the lessons come easily to them. If you had to struggle yourself to master your multiplication tables or to learn to read a bit, or if you found some struggles yourself, you can understand the struggles they face. Now, it never helps a child when he's having a problem for us to tell him, oh, well, that's easy. That's actually discouraging to say something like that, because he knows it isn't easy. If it's easy, well, then there must be something wrong with him. And when, as we go through life, we face genuine problems. And as we move through each stage, young people and then young married people and parents and so on, it's never encouraging to have somebody a generation above you, 10, 15 years above you, look back to your problem and say, oh, well, that's nothing. I mean, I know all about that. Well, to you, when you're in the thick of it, you don't know all about it, and it's very real. So what I'm trying to say is that to the child, the little first grader, third grader, fifth, whatever, the problem he's facing in understanding his math lesson or being able to form the letters properly, those difficulties can seem as impossible to him as crossing the Red Sea was to the children of Israel. I mean, there he is. There's this mountain of work. There's this barrier. I'll never be able to do this. Do you ever have that feeling? You know, a child who had that feeling, I can't do this. There's no way. And then they may feel like tearing off the paper or throwing it away or whatever. And it seems impossible. And so part of our work as teachers is to recognize that feeling and somehow encourage the child so that he can take his step, t- take the step into the Jordan and watch the waters part ahead of him, so he can take that next step and practice making the moves, practice his letters, practice his math facts, whatever, working at it. We need to remember that their problems are real. Everyone has what I call baggage here. No one lives in sterility. Life involves relationships, and everyone comes to you from a background. And so he has a home, family, church, community, and that affects how he looks at things. It affects how he feels. It affects his attitude towards school. And so you have 15 students, each one from a somewhat different home setting, some very different. And we need to at least be aware of these differences. Now, that doesn't mean we need to take time and study each one, but there's a difference between spending a lot of time trying to, we can't know everything every child is experiencing at home, so we can help him better in school. But we can at least be aware of the fact that the home environment, the other environments that he's in the evenings and weekends, they do have an effect. He's got some personal interests, some hobbies, and these things do not make him what he is, but they are relevant. So what I'm saying, I have highlighted there, they're neither deterministic. That means a child isn't what he is because of his background. But on the other hand, we can't say, well, the background, the environment, what's happening at home, that really has nothing to do with anything because we're in school and we'll learn what we're doing in school here. They do have an influence. They do have a shaping effect. And they interact with the world around them. And so to disregard his background, to disregard the other influences in the child's life would be to, in a sense, unbalance him, to create two worlds. It's so easy for a child to grow up thinking, feeling that at home is one world, the real world probably, and then I leave that behind, and then I come to school and I live in this little artificial world here for 5 hours a day, and this is an experience I have to have for 180 days, and then when May comes, then I leave that behind, and I go out into and live again in the real world. Well, somehow we have to break through that and realize that there is one life, there's really one world, and the task of teaching somehow is to have the child sense that life is integrated, it's really one life. What we learn in school is part of living, and what they do at home is real, and it's not really two worlds. That's a big subject, by the way. We'll just move on. Children do respond. This is another thing about the heart of a child. A child is a responder. He responds to you as a person, even if you don't teach anything, if you don't say anything, simply because of who you are and the type of person you are. He will respond in some way to that. And the environment of the school affects him. Think about that. The orderliness, the cleanliness, the attitude towards property, the school building, and the classmates, and also the curriculum. He is a responder, and he interacts with these things. These are all things to think about. Children worship. They do have heroes. They will worship something or someone. And so one of our tasks is to give them worthy models, worthy heroes, especially in upper elementary grades. It's a great time that children like to read about people, heroic acts, heroic deeds. Well, there are heroic people in the Bible, and there are heroic people in pages of biography. Give them worthwhile models to look at, and keep them from focusing or giving undue attention to things that don't amount to anything, idolatrous people, objects, attitudes. Children also, another thing that's in the child's heart, he wants to feel that things are worthwhile. Does this make any difference? Does what I do matter? Does this assignment mean anything? So somehow we have to think about how worthwhile these activities are going to seem to him. And a child will sometimes find fulfillment in activity. Children like to do things. They like activity. And sometimes they'll find fulfillment in something without really understanding why. Children are curious. Children like relationships. Challenges. Here's a few things to think about if you want to stimulate, if you want to feel that something's worthwhile. Stimulate the curiosity. Give them a challenge. Have them be stimulated with some new knowledge. Win the heart of the child. Win the heart of the child. Love him. Give him your heart. Malachi talks about the hearts of the fathers being turned to the children and the children to the fathers. And notice that it's the heart of the fathers to the children first. And so if we need to carry our children on our hearts and care about them, if we expect them to put their hearts into the work and care about the things that we care about. Care about their children. However, this is an important qualification. Leave the issue, the results, up to God. Some children will go through your room if you teach a while, and you'll feel that you never really click with them. You might have great relationships and great success with the majority. But there'll be a child sooner or later will come into your room and, well, it just doesn't go so well. He may get along, but he may be just happy to move through there and move on to a different teacher. You may see him go to another room and relate very well and maybe learn better from a different teacher. And that will probably happen sooner or later with a child or two. People are different, and not every teacher clicks with every child, and vice versa. And so we do our best. We care, we teach, but leave the results, the issue, up to God. Remember, and this is where it comes back to my beginning point. Remember, we are serving God. And if we can honestly say before God, Lord, I've been serving you. I've cared about this child, about this class. I've done my best. The results aren't what I thought would be good to see, but I'm leaving that up with you. My feeling about my work and teaching is not dependent entirely on how the children respond, but on my obedience to serving you. And so we love God by serve God by serving his children. Pray for wisdom. God gives wisdom liberally. He's promised that. And he will give wisdom. If you're in the position of responsibility, you can count on the wisdom you'll need for that. I like the story when Samson was going to be born, why the angel came actually twice, and Manoah, the father, asked the angel, now tell us, how shall we do with this child? And he was given specific directions of what they should do with Samson. And so when you find a child in your classroom, and you're that child's teacher, you're the one who's in a position to go before God and say, Lord, how shall I do with this child? And how shall we teach? Receive your confirmation, receive your blessing from God, not from the child's behavior. Many parents make the mistake of trying to live through the life of their children. Sometimes they want to see their children become what they were never able to become. It's wonderful to see children learn. But remember, we are serving God, and we answer to God. We receive the blessing from God. Now, sometimes he gives us that blessing through the children. We see results we think are good, and that's fine. But remember that the last comment here, never try to find your fulfillment as a teacher in the behavior of your children, in the success of your children, in what they learn. It should be only in the Lord, through the Lord. Love your students unconditionally. Never let your love for a student and your affection for a student be based upon his performance. And this is especially true with the capable student, with the able student. I've read of a student already, who a very capable student, who started doing poorly, very poorly, in school. I'm not sure it was consciously, perhaps unconsciously, but they eventually realized the reason was because the student wondered, does anybody really appreciate me simply for being a person? Or do they just appreciate me because I look good or I perform well? Search your heart and check whether the star, quote, star students, do I appreciate them more because of what they can do? That is not the basis for appreciating a person more. You love people unconditionally. And we need to especially search our hearts with our attitudes towards the, quote, good students, the ones who behave well, the ones who cooperate well. I'm not suggesting we shouldn't appreciate them, love them, but I'm saying if our love and care for them is based upon their performance, we're going to suffer the consequences sooner or later. We serve the Lord and leave the issue up to Him. Now, this other sheet I passed out is a resource sheet. I have no time to make comments on it. It's a photocopy from actually from several different books that's been out of print, I suppose, for a number of years. But I think you'll find the lists, perhaps you get some ideas from them. There are four groups of students there. I wrote the grade levels above. And it has a list of characteristics that you can expect. If you want to understand that student, if you teach grades 4, 5, and 6, just look down this list. And these are the kinds of things that you can expect from that age group. This is the way they normally behave. And then you can ask yourself, now, since they are that way, then how should I deal with that? And we don't have time to go into that. But at least you can say, if you're working with grades 4, 5, and 6, and you see them being very, very active and being doers, you say, well, all right, they're being normal. That's the heart of a 4th, 5th, and 6th grader, to be that way. And then I need to work with that. So in conclusion, let's remember we really have one person to serve. We serve God. And He's the one whom we stand or fall before. He's the one that we give answer to. And if we serve Him faithfully, it really, before Him, doesn't matter what results we see over here. We know that if it seems that we're very successful in the classroom, that's not the gauge. That's not the gauge. The Scripture says very clearly that we answer to the Lord. There are many people. We don't want to come before Him and say, well, Lord, we had good results with these classes. We never want Him to say, but you never knew me. We want to serve Him. Thank you. God bless you. And it's time for a break.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.